it is Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors. Close the blinds. Change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
On today's podcast, I'm joined by journalist and intelligence historian Trevor Barnes, and we discuss the Bulgarian spy trial at the Old Bailey, which is the most significant espionage trial in UK history since the Cold War. On this episode, Trevor discusses some new information about how the British intelligence services found out about the spy ring. I hope you find this episode interesting. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. Take care.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Trevor, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Thanks. Very well, Chris.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you for joining me at my flat today.
Absolutely.
So it's good to do one in person. It's kind of a rare thing. They usually do these online. So it's nice to see
human
you in person.
Contact, always good. As indeed. The spies know when they're trying to recruit somebody.
Indeed, indeed. So for the benefit of the audience, Trevor, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background as an intelligence historian and journalist?
Yeah, I got interested in spying when I was studying at Cambridge University, and I was lucky enough to be taught by an amazing guy called Christopher Andrew, who is, if you like, the doyen of intelligence historians. He sort of got really interested in this in the 70s. So I did an undergraduate dissertation about the special branch and the first Labour government, and then I went over and studied in America, lucky enough to get some scholarship money, and I researched and wrote about the early years of the CIA at a time in the late 70s, early 80s, when basically no one in Britain was writing about it. And that got published. Then I joined the BBC as a journalist, and I had to put spying and writing about it to one side. Apart from the fact I wrote some detective novels with a female detective, which much to my amazement got published. But the first one had a setting of what was going on in Poland in the late 40s, early 50s, when the West were trying to basically set up covert operations and things like that. And then I got back into spying again when I semi-retired from my final job working at the communications regulator, because I changed careers from being a BBC journalist to becoming a lawyer. And I researched and wrote the first kind of definitive history of the Portland spy ring.
Yeah.
Since then, I've got casting around for things. It struck me that there was a kind of gap whereby people were seeing these amazing spy trials that were coming up, and you got a series of journalists who were covering them, but not people who had a more historical background. So that was why I decided to attend this remarkable trial of the Bulgarian spy ring.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, so that's what we're going to talk a bit about today. So you chose to actually go there in person rather than reporting from a distance. Why did you do that?
Well, I did it because I, first of all, saw some headlines in August 23 in the newspapers, which were reporting the fact that these five Bulgarians had been arrested, and they were accused of being responsible for some spying operations on behalf of Moscow. This was just before the preliminary trial hearings were taking place, and I thought, this sounds fascinating. So I went along to the pre-trial hearing, but at the time I went into the public gallery and found it was absolutely hopeless, because you're miles away from what was going on. You're on the This is all at the Old Bailey, by the way, on the first floor. You were distant from the lawyers. You couldn't find out what was going on. And I thought, there's so much here to be looked at. No one quite knew what was going to happen. So I basically approached the Evening Standard, and they wanted me, and very happy for me, and in fact commissioned me to attend pretty much every day of the trial and then write a big piece at the end from a kind of intelligence historian's point of view. So that was how I got into the trial.
What was it actually like sort of being there? Because I've been to the Old Bailey and it's not a particularly pleasant place. What was it actually like sort of just seeing these people in person? What kind of atmosphere was there in court?
Well, there was quite a difference between the pre-trial hearings and the actual trial itself. And what was fascinating was following that, because there were lots of skirmishes going on legally between the defence team and the prosecution. In particular, one of the main defendants was a guy called Orlin Rousseff. We can talk about him a little bit in a moment, who was living in a 33-room rundown hotel in Great Yarmouth, from which it turned out he was running this spy ring. And he, I discovered subsequently from the police and others, was an amazing tale teller. And he was, in fact, one of the few, when they got arrested, we'll talk about that a bit later, who was talking to the police as opposed to saying no comment. And he was so self-confident. You can see this in the dock when they're behind the glass. And he sort of came in talkative, chatting to the other defendants, smiling. And, you know, the police told me that there in the police station, he was talking away. They thought, you know, very cockily convinced he could get himself off. And in the pre-trial hearings, he was talking about him working for Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service, possibly for the Serbians. And then that was sort of one issue about the disclosure of the documents, because he and the other defence team wanted more and more of the documents to be disclosed. And of course, the prosecution were desperately trying to kind of get the documents into order and disclose what was necessary. And the other issue was also about anonymity, in particular, which of the witnesses on behalf of the police and or question mark the security service, although they were never ever mentioned, might appear. And I was also interested at that time in thinking about the parallels and analogies with the remarkable 1961 trial of the Portland spy ring, which in fact was the biggest Russia-linked spy ring trial in the UK before this Bulgarian trial.
Yeah, very historic that, very historic. And I'm sure we'll be talking about this Bulgarian spy ring for years to come. So yeah, you're right there in a moment of history, really, which I'm sure you'd love to have been doing when you were writing Dead Doubles, but that was a long time ago now.
Well, you know, this is what I wanted to see, what's going on with espionage now,
yeah,
you know, in the early 2020s and mid-2020s.
Yeah, did you get a real sense in the early stages of how how historic and important this was, or was it only kind of dawn on you as the trial went on?
It only really became clear, Chris, as the trial progressed, because in the pre-trial hearings, there's also another issue all about the interpretation of the legislation, because it was decided by the prosecution to charge the majority of the six defendants with the offence of conspiracy to spy. And there are various reasons why they, in fact, alighted on that particular charge as opposed to any other. But it did mean that there was an agreement on that. But none of the evidence in the pre-trial hearings was disclosed to the press. And the real difference about being in the well of the court when you're an accredited press person is you're there, you are shown and given copies of all the documents, all the photos, everything that's in evidence. If you're up in a public gallery, you can't see this. And also, you can, if you're unsure about something, you can talk to the other, you know, partners in crime, by which I mean jokingly the journalists, because there is this great camaraderie amongst them. And also, you get access to the lawyers. So in breaks between parts of the hearing, you can go up and say, I didn't quite understand that. Do you know what this is? And also, they'll talk to you outside the courtroom and it's broken. How did the day's proceedings go? So it was only really when the trial started, which was in November of 2024, and the prosecution produced these enormous A3-sized files, which contained an enormous, gigantic number of telegram messages which had been extracted by the police and possibly with help from the security service and other things. We'll talk about that a bit in a moment, were disclosed, plus all the other photographs, that you suddenly realise here was this treasure trove of documentary evidence about what the Russian intelligence services were doing and how they were interacting with their agents based in the UK.
Might be a good idea for the benefit of some listeners who may have missed this trial entirely to just give us the bare bones of who was on trial and what they were accused of.
It's a bit complicated, but I will try and simplify it. Originally, after the arrests, which took place in February 2023, there were five accused. Now, it took a while for the police to sift through the material that they've got, and we'll talk about that as well, this amazing material, this treasure trove of stuff, for them to decide what they wanted to bring forward and how to structure it for the jury. So there were six, and three of them pleaded guilty before the trial started. So these three were Orlin Rousseff, who was in his late 40s. He was a guy based in the Great Yarmouth Hotel with this, as he himself described it, his Indiana Jones warehouse of spying equipment. And he was a spycraft, an expert and hacker. He was the leader of the spying gang, okay? His number two was a guy called Bayzid Zambazov, who was 44, so a little bit younger than him. And he was, in effect, Rousseff's sidekick, and he was a hospital driver. And the third person who pleaded guilty before the trial started was a man called Ivan Stoyanov, who was a bit younger, age 35. And he didn't admit to the conspiracy to spy. He just admitted spying. There are subtle reasons why I think he did that. And we weren't allowed to report that at the time. We could only report he pleaded guilty after the trial had ended. So those three had pleaded guilty. Now, the advantage of that to the prosecution was there were two out of the six defendants who had pleaded guilty to conspiracy to spy. So there was factual evidence that there was a conspiracy. They didn't need to prove that anymore. So that was useful to the prosecution. So that's three of the original defendants. But that meant because they'd pleaded guilty, they weren't actually in the witness box. They weren't standing trial before the jury. Then there were three other defendants who were the three who were standing trial. These were one man and two women. The two women were, first of all, Katerina Ivanova. She's now 34. She was the partner of Zambazov, who I said was Rousseff's number two. And she was a lab technician working essentially for the same company as Zambazov. Then there was a young woman called Vania Gabarova, who was 31. She was, in fact, it transpired, Zambazov's lover, because there were some quite tangled love lives all mixed with this. And she ran a beauty parlor called Pretty Woman in West London in Acton. And then the last defendant was a guy called Tihomir Ivanchev. He's aged 40. He had been Gabarova's lover for a while. He was a quite successful open water swimmer, and this emerged during the trial as well. And all three of those were found guilty unanimously of conspiracy to spy for Russia. Behind it all, however, was this shadowy figure. He was originally on these telegram messages known only as Rupert Titch. And he was identified positively, for reasons I can talk about, as the mysterious man called Jan Masalek. Now, he's one of the most wanted men in Europe. He had been the chief operating officer of this, in effect, Ponzi scheme, West German company called Wirecard, which went bust in June 2020, leaving 1.6 million pounds of debts. But he, when this company went bust, had already skedaddled. And in fact, it transpired he'd gone via Belarus and emerged in Moscow and had links with Russian intelligence. So he was the ghost, if you like, at the feast. And he was a real puppet master, because all the messages showed that he was communicating with Rousseff in particular, and tasking them with particular operations. And the trial revolved around six spying operations, which were essentially surveillance operations on dissidents and journalists that Moscow didn't like. The most famous of which is a guy called Christo Grozev, originally from Bulgaria, a Bellingcat journalist. And he, for example, did a lot in exposing the Russian military intelligence guys behind the Salisbury poisonings, and also the attempt by Russian intelligence to poison the late Alexei Navalny by putting Novichok in his underpants.
Yeah, yeah. Bellingcat do excellent work.
Grozev was clearly a target. Another one was a guy called Roman Dobrokhotov, who's Russian, who is involved with a really remarkable journalistic investigation outfit called The Insider.
Yes, yeah, brilliant paper, yeah. So you've uncovered new information about how the British authorities first became aware of this spy ring. So what can you tell us about the origins of the investigation and why that starting point matters?
It all really started with one of the questions that, for me, was interesting at the trial, which was indeed, how on earth did the British get onto this spy ring? How and when? And this was, of course, not answered at all in the trial. It was sort of hanging over, and there was speculation that it could have been a foreign intelligence agency. But one of the operations that was documented in the trial and talked about was an operation to have surveillance at the very important American airbase near Stuttgart in southern Germany called Patch Barracks. It's also quite important because you've got a very, very significant national security agency, NSA, SIGINT facility there, in effect the European headquarters, as I understand it. So you could understand why the Russians might be interested, but the messages told an even more interesting story, which was that the Russians had information, Russian intelligence, that the Ukrainians were sending a number of their troops to learn at Patch Barracks how to operate Patriot missiles, which, of course, were being deployed very effectively in Ukraine against Russian aircraft and drones and missiles and that sort of thing. And in effect, what the plan was to go with this really, really effective interception equipment called an IMPSI grabber, which could intercept mobile phones details. So you could work out what the number was and that sort of thing of these troops from Ukraine who were going to Patch Barracks to be trained. And the idea, as far as people who were informed was to work out, was to get the details of the phone numbers of these people so that when they were back deployed in Ukraine, in the particular places where they were operating these Patriot missiles, the Russians would send in the drones, send in the missiles, and basically kill these people and attack the Patriot missiles. So if it had actually worked itself through, it would have been very effective. But to go back to your question, how did it all start? Another bit of speculation was that because the spy ring, or three of them, had planned and went over on a couple of preliminary runs to do the surveillance in Stuttgart in October, November, it was possible that Western intelligence had perhaps clocked them on the perimeter, intercepted their communications, and that was how they first got tipped off, because then when they'd have come back from Stuttgart into the UK, they could have been tailed. But what I've discovered, fascinatingly, is confirmation that it was, in fact, the American intelligence that tipped the British off. Now, my two separate and reliable sources refused and or were unable to tell me which branch, you know, was it CIA, FBI, was it SIGINT, Signals Intelligence Interception by the NSA, what it was, or was it a human source of intelligence? Because very often, if you've got what are called clean skins, i.e. you've got agents who've got no record whatsoever on your files of being linked to the Russians, like, for example, people working in the Russian embassy, you know, a number of those will obviously be Russian intelligence operatives working undercover. If you're a clean skin, it's quite hard to find out what's going on. So, as in the Portland spy ring, indeed, back in 1960, it was the CIA that had an agent that tipped the Americans off about one of the Portland spies called Harry Houghton being recruited by the KGB, and that was what gave MI5 back in 1960 the first lead onto investigating the Portland spy ring. So the same thing happened in this case. And it was important because if the British hadn't had that tip-off, it's quite possible that that spy ring could have carried on operating for an unknown period, and it could have well transpired that people like Christo Grozev and Roman Drobokatov could have found themselves the subject of a kidnap or some sort of poisoning attack or anything. We just don't know.
Yeah, indeed. And I know we have a special relationship with the Americans, and I know intelligence sort of sharing is quite sort of routine and standard. But at the same time, what is interesting is that this external tip-off, as you've just mentioned, is what brought this spy ring to MI5's attention. So what does that sort of tell us a bit about the scale of modern counterintelligence work and the pressures for MI5 operating today?
Well, I mean, the pressures are immense for a whole lot of reasons. I mean, it's partly because modern counterintelligence work is having to work in a kind of digital environment. There's just so much more information around of all different sources. Plus, you've got so many different types of threat from just taking Russia. One example, you've got cyber attacks, influence operations. You've got transnational repression, in other words, trying to, you know, take action against the people who are dissidents against you based in the other country.
Yeah, I've had that with Iran recently. Yeah.
Iran, you've got China, so on and so forth. And then you've got the classic spying, of course, where you've actually got people like the Bulgarian spies who are operating against your interest. So, and of course, the Director General of MI5, Ken McCallum, has gone on the record recently as saying that his organization has had to pivot away from focusing on terrorism to state threats. Some similar things said by Blaise Metrawelli, the new head of MI6, who talked about the export of chaos, was her words, by Russia. As I said earlier, these particular Bulgarian agents were all clean skins. They weren't on the radar screen of British intelligence at all. So there's no trace of them that anyone can get hold of. It is and continues to be a really big challenge for MI5. And if you've got people who are clean skins, not just Bulgarians like this, they could be classic Russian illegal spies like Gordon Lonsdale, Conor Molody in the Portland spy ring, who are people trained for a long, long period by Russian intelligence. Russia has still got a number of these, undoubtedly. They're still regarded as very, very valuable by the Russians when it works. So we know, as a matter of fact, that following the Russian invasion of Ukraine in February 22, not only were a number of diplomats operating from Russian embassies basically thrown out across Western capitals, but also counterintelligence cooperation. And this led to a number of illegal spies in Slovenia, Greece, and other places being kind of found out. Some of them were obviously tipped off and felt that was going to happen, so they fled before they could be arrested. So it's a continuing battle for MI5.
Let's take a break and be right back with more.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
These individuals were pretty much sort of disposable and not these sort of deep cover spies that's within Cold War tradition, if we put it that way.
Yeah, some people have said that this trend which has been revealed of Russia, particularly post the 2022 invasion of Ukraine and the expulsion of these number of diplomats, meant that the Russians had to become more flexible. Now, they have in the past used low-level agents like these Bulgarians historically. There's very little new, actually, in spying. If you look back at over the millennia, some of the techniques are the same. But they definitely had to think afresh about how to achieve their aims. Because deep down, the ideology in Moscow at the moment is, although Russia is not officially at war with the West and Britain, it is in effect unofficially so. So they view it's perfectly valid for them to organise sabotage operations, take action against people who they think are opposed to their interests, perhaps undermining their position, Russia's position in terms of the credibility and the legitimacy of their invasion of Ukraine. So what they have done, and there's more and more evidence of this, but the Bulgarian spy ring is the best example, is recruit people of different nationalities, sometimes low-level criminals, sometimes like the Bulgarian spy ring, people who, frankly, were motivated by a combination, it seems, of money principally, but also an ideological and cultural sympathy, shall we say, for Russia, to operate on their behalf and be paid quite well for it in cryptocurrency. And some people then say, well, these people are disposable. The point is that the Russians, based on my knowledge of this trial and also the Wagner Dylan Earl trial, which also took place last year, this is the arson attack in Leighton in East London on a warehouse connected with a Ukrainian businessman that was, for example, sending Starlink satellite equipment to aid the Ukrainians in their battle against Russia. People were saying, well, these people are disposable. But the Russians don't really see anyone who's of use to them as disposable. They don't want them to be exposed. In fact, there's evidence, for example, in the messages in the Dylan Earl trial that they were advising Earl to take care and make sure that he, you know, was not doing anything that was going to expose him. It was they who told him to delete messages. I mean, one of the bizarre features of the Bulgarian trial was that there was so much material collected from their defendants, and particularly Rusev's equipment, that this provided all the evidence that the prosecution wanted. If more of that had been deleted, which is what a fully trained agent probably would have done on an automatic basis, it would have been much harder to prosecute them. So the Russians don't start off with people thinking that they're disposable, but what they will do is the Russians will make use of people as long as they can, and then just when they are exposed, probably be internally saddened at the loss of agents who are operating for them, but they will learn the lessons from what's happened and to take particular care in future. And it may well be from the post-mortem that was undoubtedly done on this case by, you know, whether it be the FSB or military intelligence, the GU, or the SVR, their foreign intelligence agency, they'll be learning lessons and say, well, how can we try and protect the people like this in future? But the difference is that the Russians and the Russian intelligence agencies do not owe the same loyalty to people like this as they owe to their own agents who are trained. So Operation Ghost Stories, those people were all part of a repatriation package, spy swap on the tarmac, back to Moscow. People who are familiar with the Portland spy ring will recall that the Russians continued to militate, act behind the scenes to, first of all, get Gordon Lonsdale, real name Conor Mollody, out of British jail, and also the Cohens, Loner and Morris, who were operating under the cover names of Peter and Helen Kroger. So the Russians really had that long-term thinking, and that's in effect their contract with these people. You will undertake a very, very risky business on behalf of Russia, and we will do all our best to get you back if you are found out and jailed.
You touched upon something just a moment ago that makes me want to ask a random question here. So with the Bulgarian spies, you mentioned that they were there was a slight ideological motivation for some of them, maybe. And I was wondering if you could expand a bit on that, because the reason I ask is I've noticed in the last few years of a lot of sort of recent spy scandals across Europe, you tend to find Russians are managing to recruit people in the West, should we put it that way, who have a slight far-right leaning, because Russia sort of is presenting itself in this sort of far-right way as the kind of the savior of the white Christian world. Did you pick up on anything like that? Were these individuals either motivated by far right or far left ideology at all?
There was no evidence of that, Chris, in the messages, or indeed when two out of the three defendants were in the witness box and asked about their views. What I meant by that was that there were interchanges between Rousseff and Masalek, for example, about the things they were asked to do and the targets, you know, people like Grozev. And clearly Rousseff was kind of sympathetic to the idea that Grozev was causing problems for Russia. And he was quite happy to get involved in taking action in, first of all, finding information about him and then putting a watch on him to provide information back to Moscow to do whatever they might want to do to him, you know, if they have an opportunity. So it's more in that line and joking about things like, and they made a joke of it, and they thought about the Skripal stuff and the mess that had been done there by the poor tradecraft, spycraft, by the GRU officers. And I should imagine back in Moscow when it all came out that, you know, they'd been trailed pretty thoroughly, and Scotland Yard did a really good job, SO15, in tracking the two of the GRU people in particular. There was high embarrassment about it. And that was a sort of line that I meant, a general sympathy for Russia, because of course Bulgaria has always been close to Russia. Cyrillic alphabet, languages are quite similar. And there undoubtedly still is in Bulgaria a trend, a bit like in Serbia, who are quite sympathetic to, you know, if you like, Putin's view of a greater Russia involved with the Orthodox Church and so on and so forth. And so on. And one area where undoubtedly I think there was some sympathy with more right-wing views would be, for example, the views about women, which were expressed in the messages, you know, talking about Gavrilova as a kind of a honeypot and being good-looking, and she'd be used as a trap and that sort of thing, which is, it tends to be a trope that you get on more right-wing circles. You see it with the attitude towards the Epstein files, and, you know, you get a number of people on the right who kind of, you may have perhaps involved with Epstein, who treated women in that ghastly, disposable way.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you for that. So I'm going to move us to the investigation a bit more. Can you talk to us a little bit about the role of SO15 in this investigation and at what point they were brought into the case?
Well, SO15 is a department of Scotland Yard set up in the early 2000s that's called Counterterrorism Command. And it was set up really in response to the growing terrorism threat, as the name suggests. But when it was set up, it was subsumed, the old special branch into it. The special branch played two roles, really. It was set up first of all in the 19th century in response to Irish terrorism, the Fenians. But it had a role always in national security. It would collect information from local constabularies about communists and other people who are regarded as possible threats to national security. But also they were brought in by the security service, MI5, when it came time to do the arrests. So this happened, for example, with the Portland spy ring. So that role came into SO15. So SO15 now has an important role of being engaged in and undertaking sensitive national security investigations. It's headed by a very interesting man called Dominic Murphy. He's commander, one of two commanders, and he's responsible for this bit, national security. He, Dominic, has been in counterterrorism for 22 years, so pretty much from the beginning of SO15, in place for longer. And what I've discovered is that, and they told me and confirmed it, because I had fascinating interviews with Dominic Murphy and the senior investigating officer and one of his senior aides working with him in New Scotland Yard. I was kind of shown into this room. There were a couple of guys from, you know, communications, and then I had Dominic Murphy and these two other men, and they made it quite clear I was not allowed to name anyone other than Dominic Murphy. Murphy himself, he revealed, has actually now been sanctioned by the Russians. At the end of last year, I wasn't aware of this, obviously for his role in things like the Skripal, Salisbury, he's obviously be regarded as a Russophobe. But I mean, now, to be sanctioned like that is quite remarkable as a policeman. So I was able to sort of talk to them. And one of the things they said was that they talked about how they got involved and the first time it happened. But their role really is to, when MI5 has a national security case, which we talk about how and when MI5 may have got involved in a moment, when they feel that they've investigated the level that they wish, they will want to bring in SO15. And this will be to take the investigation forward using classic detective work in a way that the police can do. They gave one example, for example, of liaison with local government. Apparently, the police have better contacts and access to sensitive information that local government has, presumably about council tax records, who owns things, than the security service would want. But also, from the time that SO15 is involved, they will be preparing. The senior investigating officer told me about this. They'll be, from day one, they'll be getting a plan for the arrests ready, because they know they're being brought in at a moment when, if you like, the fruit is ripening. And at any moment, there might be information coming in, and they didn't tell me this, but we know that, I know this from working on various previous cases. At any moment, the alarm bell could go off. They might be thinking that the people they're watching are going to skedaddle and go abroad, or there's a sudden increase in the threat level, and you know, the gun will be fired, and they have to go in and get the arrests organised. So that's essentially what they're doing, a combination of investigation and arrests. And then obviously, having got the arrests, working with the Crown Prosecution Service to see if there's a case that can be made against these people.
Yeah, and that's the vital bit. And that's why the police need to be there, because MI5 is not a law enforcement agency. So they are not necessarily collecting evidence per se. They're kind of collecting information. So that's why the SO15 is so important in all this, isn't it? To be able to make it a prosecutable case.
Yeah. Because, I mean, normally, and I'm sure that happened in this case, when MI5 were tipped off, I don't know exactly the route, whether the Americans told MI6 first, or you know, the NSA told GCHQ, but it came back to MI5. They investigated this, and there are a series of liaison groups which SO15 is on, which will obviously have links with, there'll be people from MI6, people from GCHQ, and SO50 and MI5. They'll be on these liaison groups. And at some date, probably, well, at the end of 2022, this is whenever SO15 got brought in. And interestingly, and it showed actually how in SO15, I think there isn't a very, very high and rigid hierarchy. So, for example, the Portland spying, when the information came from the CIA, it came via the American embassy, who then reported it went direct to the director general, at the time was Roger Hollis. Whereas in this case, SO15 said that actually Dominic Murphy first heard about this spy ring from his senior investigating officer, who's on the liaison group.
Yeah.
So it's kind of devolved, kind of more flexible position than I think may have been the case, you know, 60-odd years ago. And having sort of learned about that, then obviously I asked about the size of their team and they weren't willing to share it. But they said it was very tight at the beginning, partly because SO15 are very aware of security, so they need to know. So the more people in the Met who have heard about this sensitive case, the more there could be a leak, possibly that gets back to the Russians, and then before you know where you are, these people have flown out from Luton and they're back in Bulgaria or elsewhere, you know. But also because they don't want to commit too many resources to something before they know what's going to go on. Because SO15, although it's particularly on their state threat side, has increased the size of their contingent of guys working on that and moved them across from classic terrorism than might have been to do it. They've got limited resources, like indeed the security service. And I remember having a fascinating conversation with the marvellous former director general called Jonathan Evans, now Lord Evans. And he jokingly said to me, you know, in his way up, he said, I was just lucky that, because you're always having to readjust resources. And if you take resources off a case and it goes bang and there's some bomb attack, it's a bit like slow horses. Jokingly, one of those guys in slow horses was basically pointed out for having made the wrong judgment call at the time. And Lord Evans said, you know, I was lucky. You know, I had a lot of very, it's obviously a very, very competent guy, but he also said, you know, I was fortunate because none of the cases I was handled went bang. You know, he had the resources, people weren't taken off at his judgment to go somewhere else at a crucial time. So that's essentially how SO15 got started. It was getting the classic detective work. As I said, we don't know actually what the information was that was handed across by MI5 to SO15, what they are asked. We don't know what covert surveillance, interception, which was almost certainly done. We don't know, as a matter of fact. MI5 have remained very, very tight-lipped about this case, as they were at the time of this Bulgarian trial and immediately afterwards. It wasn't just me. Other people who work in this area said that it was very tight-lipped, and MI5 now are not saying anything either. So obviously SO15 don't want to start saying things out of turn. But clearly there was some sort of surveillance and a file was created. It may have been on, the original information may have been no more than, look, there is this guy, Rupert Titch. We think he is Jan Masalek. He's in communication with this man, Orlin Rousseff, in Great Yarmouth. We think they are doing some surveillance. And that may have been what MI5 got. They may have done some surveillance. Interception of Rousseff's phone calls may have placed a bug, possibly covertly, inside his Yarmouth, Great Yarmouth hotel. We just don't know. They may have monitored to some extent the travel plans. But anyway, at the end of 2022, SO15 were brought in to develop that and get more information and certainly prepare for a possible set of arrests.
One random question as well. Did you get any idea of any tensions between MI5 and SO15 in this case? Because there have been historical tensions between them in the past.
None whatsoever.
No, that's good.
None whatsoever. I mean, understandably, if there were any such tensions, they wouldn't share them with me because they want to give an image of everything being fine, which is quite interesting because I heard from various sources after the Skripal poisonings that there was a certain amount of tension between MI5 and MI6 with, in effect, as I understand it, I may have got this wrong, but as I was told it, MI5 in effect saying to MI6, come on, this guy was under a really, really great threat. You know, why don't you take more measures to protect him? Because he Skripal had, of course, been an MI, interesting and important MI6 agent. But that was all behind the scenes, and nothing more has emerged about that. And one hopes that they will learn. I mean, I know from other sources that you get conflicts between special forces in the UK about, you know, SAS against the SBS, and that they don't always cooperate as publicly they would like to think.
What tipped the balance towards arresting these suspects in 2023 rather than just carrying on watching them?
Well, I found out more about this from talking to the SO15 people, because in a pre-verdict trial briefing, which SO15 did for the press, Dominic Murphy gave the impression to members of the press that it was the date of the arrest, which was the 8th of February, 2023, was not related to the fact that it was the spy ring people involved with the surveillance of the American base at Patch Barracks in south of Germany was about to happen. They're about to go for real within the next day or so, actually out to Germany. So everyone assumed that that was the trigger, and Dominic Murphy gave the impression that that wasn't the case. But in fact, it's a much more nuanced picture. SO15, Dominic Murphy confirmed it was a whole series of factors that were coming into play. One was that they knew the travel plans of the accused, the people they're about to arrest. So what's interesting about that is they clearly knew the travel plans through surveillance. You don't, you know, an interception. So that confirms indirectly that the security service or SO15 were already locked into the communication systems of the suspects, people are going to arrest, before the 8th of February. And bearing in mind, and he said, well, we knew the travel plans, and he talked about knowing they were going to go to Patch Barracks. So it played a role. Secondly, they were aware of the fact that there was new targeting coming from Mosalik, and they knew that he had targeted Grozev and Dobrokhotov earlier on. Now, what we don't know was whether there was any new targeting in January of a month before the arrest or not, because none of those messages were disclosed. So it's perfectly possible that Mosalik was actually giving new instructions to his team about doing new and potentially bad things in January, you know, just before the arrests. And that may have tipped it over. And we know from an interview that Christo Grozev gave after the trial verdicts that he was then living in New York. He's had to move out of London and live in New York for his own protection. He was actually contacted by the police stroke FBI in New York, and he was planning to fly out to Austria that night. And he was said, oh, no, you shouldn't. Oh, no, you're not. We found there's a team what has been watching you now for several months. Clearly, that was the Bulgarian team. You can't go. And I gather that Dobrokhotov was given a similar warning. So something was going on. And also, SO15 knew that the five suspects that they were thinking of arresting were in the UK at the same time in known locations. Now, again, they obviously needed to have appropriate surveillance to find out where Rusev was going to be, where Zambazov is going to be with Ivanova, Gabarova, and also Stoyanov, that they could be arrested. So that was what triggered it. Obviously, there was a combination of factors together that said we need to arrest them now because we could let them carry on observing them, but it's too big a risk.
At the centre of this case is Jan Mosalik. And can you talk to us a little bit about, sort of from what you've uncovered, how we should understand his relationship with the Russian intelligence services?
Well, this is all pretty murky, Chris. I mean, there's been some really, really good investigative work done in Germany by the magazine Der Spiegel, with actually Christo Grozev was on the team that was digging up material about him. And they've discovered that in around about 2014, there was a man called Stanislav Petlinsky, who was introduced to Mosalik, who at that stage is chief operating officer of Wirecard, introduced him in Germany. And this then developed further, so that apparently there were trips out to Syria that were paid for by Russian intelligence, even a flight in a Russian aircraft. There was a very, very glamorous girlfriend, Russian girlfriend, who hooked up with Mosalik. And at the same time, Mosalik was developing certain business deals with people who are being interviewed by journalists in America, in Germany. He was developing a whole lot of different business deals and influence deals. And there's also some evidence that he, Mosalik, commissioned some surveillance on journalists who were sniffing out the early smoke, so to speak, of the signs of the fire that was going to become the raging fire of the collapse of Wirecard, in particular the FT, who were very hot and investigating this story. So that's the sort of background of Mosalik. And someone who interviewed a man called Brennan House, who was a key figure in Wirecard, who was involved with the current trial in Germany of the man who was chief executive of Wirecard, a man called Marcus Braun. That trial's been going on in Munich now for a couple of years. Verdict expected later this year. Marcus Braun thought widely to get a 10-year prison sentence. But anyway, when a contact of mine spoke to this guy called Brennan House, he told my contact that, because he knew Mosalik really well, because lots of people talk about Mosalik, but they've not really worked with him that much. And he said he just loved playing games. He was a man who wanted to be a puppet master. And that was obviously the nature of his operation. And that was why he was useful to Russian intelligence, such that when As I mentioned earlier, Wirecard collapsed in June 2020. The Russians were clearly instrumental in smuggling him out of Germany and through Belarus into Moscow. And there's new research that's been done recently by the insider, which Roman Dobrokhotov is involved with, which has confirmed that Masalek's now living in Moscow. He's got a Russian girlfriend who has a lot of links with the intelligence service. He, Masalek, was pictured outside the FSB headquarters. And there's some evidence that he's traveled to the front line in Ukraine, possibly with some sort of protection. And none of this means that he's working still for the Russian intelligence services. In fact, there are certain sources suggesting that his position in Moscow is somewhat vulnerable now that you've had the Bulgarian spy ring exposed. And in fact, this insider article published a photograph of Masalek on the streets of Moscow with his girlfriend, showing, in fact, he'd had a hair transplant.
Oh, okay. And isn't he living undercover as a priest or something in Russia?
Yeah, when he arrived in Moscow, the Russian intelligence service provided him with at least one cover, that of a Russian Orthodox priest, which subsequently got changed. So he's probably got several aliases. But he's a known figure now. I mean, and once you're exposed like that, the value that you have and your profile you have is not necessarily productive in a sort of intelligence sphere.
Now, forgive me, I may have missed this and you may have said this. Was Masalek recruited by the Russians or did he volunteer for the Russians?
No one quite knows. And but behind your question is recruited for what? What was he recruited as? Because there's no evidence that he's ever recruited and made an officer of any of those services. I mean, Russians traditionally are very, very wary about people who may have done an amazing service over a number of years being formally inducted into their service. A good example is Kim Philby. Could you ask for a more loyal servant of the Soviet state than Philby, who betrayed Western secrets for decades? And when he was, exfiltrated out of Lebanon to Moscow, he was treated, to some extent at arm's length. And, he took a long while before he was invited along to give talks to, KGB trainees and that sort of thing. So highly unlikely he's ever been an officer. What I think is far more likely was that he was really seen as a useful factotum, someone who could be used, who was fluent in several languages, very charming, good contacts, who could be an intermediary, which of course is useful to the Russians because it gives them deniability. They can say, he's never been a diplomat of the Russian Federation, this guy. He was operating at arm's length from various people. He was manipulated by various, shadowy figures. So basically he would have been useful in a situation like that with Rusev, because partly the connection between Rusev and Masalek went back quite a long way. There was one telegram message where Rusev actually says, we've known each other since 2014. And there's speculation that Rusev may have been this freelance or one of the freelance surveillance people that was employed while Masalek was at Spycraft to undertake surveillance on the people, the journalists and others who were sniffing out what was going wrong with Wirecard.
Interesting. Thank you for that. Is there anything else about Masalek you'd like to add before we move on?
Only that there's a mystery. No one quite knows what he's doing, what his status is, what will happen to him in the longer term. I mean, he's clearly got a fake identity or identities. It is interesting that the insider did get evidence that he went to the Ukrainian front line. I mean, there's evidence during the trial that Masalek liked to dress up in military fatigues, but there's no evidence that he actually is a person of physical courage or even went out there to do any fighting. But clearly, the Russians have got an interest in ensuring that Mossadegh stays under their control, because he obviously knows a number of secrets, and they would find it inconvenient probably if Mossadegh was exfiltrated out of Russia into the West. On the other hand, my German contacts tell me, in fact, that Mossadegh is full of embarrassing secrets about the German elite. So the Germans really don't want him back. You know, it's a bit like the Epstein case with all the elite that are being protected, a lot of people say, by the people around President Trump, because it's just too embarrassing. And hence the battle, the continuing battle the Epstein survivors have to get more and more documents revealed. And you can see why. I mean, you've got half the documents revealed, and even in their redacted form, half of them, 3 million out of the 6 million, have left so many kind of reputations as corpses around the world, not just in the UK, but in France. I mean, ironically, it's actually in America that so far the repercussions in terms of elite responsibility are far less than in other countries.
Yeah, his placement obviously in Wirecard gave him access to probably a lot of files about who was buying what, and I don't know, they used it for money laundering, etc. So that must have made him a very useful person.
Yeah, and knowledge of how cryptocurrencies worked, because Wirecard was a payments company originally. I mean, it used to handle payments, for example, for pornographic outlets and that sort of thing, and then and also gambling. And as governments tightened up the rules in the around 2010, both before and afterwards, so obviously the business model of Wirecard became more and more difficult to sustain, because clearly they were handling dirty money.
Let's take a break and be right back with more.
Yo, it's Jay Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win. Let's Chumba.
Yeah.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
So let's sort of move into the arrests and then the actual case itself. So espionage cases are very difficult to prosecute, because there's a sort of line between secrecy and maybe the secret nature of the evidence against the accused. And then obviously there's a demand for open justice. So can you talk to us a little bit about the arrests and that awkward line that this espionage case had to sort of tread in court?
Well, it was fascinating talking to SO15 about how they plan arrests. I mean, this is a really, really big operation. There were arrests taken in multiple locations simultaneously in the early hours of the 8th of February 2023, with over 100 officers involved, the majority from SO15. Now, obviously, Great Yarmouth is on the Norfolk coast. They had to liaise with Norfolk police. But as Dominic Murphy said, he was very aware of the impact it would have, having a whole bunch of guys wearing balaclavas, you know, bushing up and down the stairs and in properties in the early hours of Great Yarmouth. But at the same time, they had to organise the arrests in go to Sambazov's flat, go to Gabarova's flat, go to the places of work where Ivanova and Sambazov were, and of course Stoyanov. So you see why it was a big thing. They had to ensure the people were there. But even so, there are potential surprises. But they said that it's really important they deliberately make these arrests noisy and quite intimidating, in order essentially to try and secure as much of the digital evidence as possible. Because what they want is a bit of shock and awe. They want to separate the suspects from their digital devices, because it's so easy to dispose of them, delete things. The other factor is if they're closed at the time, they are much harder to access. Normally what happens is if a person's arrested with a mobile phone or a digital device, the police will ask for the PIN number. But there's no obligation to provide it, and a lot of suspects don't. And if that's the case, the police then get an order, and then they have got various software programs that in a number of cases enable them to access the material on that particular digital device. But in this case, there was a lucky break, as the senior investigating officer said, because such was a surprise that they caught Rousseff, who was up in the morning, he was working at 6 o'clock in the morning, when they stormed in. And his laptop was open, and it was on a page all about hacking. And what it meant was that they could secure that device, obviously lock it down to ensure it stayed open. And they didn't need to worry about getting a PIN number or anything to get into it. So, in fact, they confirmed to me that even in that 72-hour period during which the five suspects were arrested and held in Borough Police Station in London, the police, SO15, had some access to a number of those messages. An early stage. But if that doesn't happen, you've got problems. I mean, a good example was in the Dylan Earl arson trial that I talked to about, you know, the arson attack in East London, where one of the people involved with this kind of ring, a guy called Ashton Evans, who was living in Newport, he was accused not of involvement with the arson, but of basically covering up information about a terrorist act. There was evidence in the messages that he was part of the circle and knew what was going on. When the police came to arrest him, his parents, for whatever reason, slowed down the police, getting up to his bedroom by 2 or 3 minutes, not allowing them immediate access and that sort of thing. And the police are convinced, this came out in evidence, that he disposed of his old mobile at that time, which would undoubtedly have contained a lot of evidence. We live in a digital age, so digital evidence is absolutely crucial to making sure that you can actually hopefully get some evidence of direct contacts between the suspect and the people who are running them, basically the Russians. And you can get some insight in real time as to what their intentions were. This has all moved on dramatically from the times of the Portland spy ring. That was an analog age, and we're in a digital age. In the Portland spy ring case, the evidence was partly surveillance evidence of the MI5 watchers who were following Gordon Lonsdale around in London to different places where he went, and then relying on the kind of analog paper evidence that was found, not always paper, but solid evidence of involvement with the KGB. For example, the coding slips for the one-time pads and that sort of thing. And had to be, so just different type of evidence. These days, the digital evidence is absolutely crucial. And if you can't get that, it's almost impossible to get a successful prosecution. Good example, people should watch out for this. Last autumn, SO15 arrested in two separate operations, six people, three of them in Essex, three in London, who were suspected of being involved with some sort of Russian spy ring. Now, they were never named. They've not been charged. And SO15 said, in effect, it's a matter of luck. You go in, you have evidence, presumably based on covert surveillance and that sort of thing, suggesting that these people are involved in bad things. So you organise the arrests, but it's only when you've arrested the people, you've got their digital devices, you've downloaded as much material you can to see what evidence you've got. Then you go to the CPS and say, can we make the charges stick? Is actually a case here? And only then can you go public and start naming people, because obviously you've got problems otherwise with prejudicing a fair trial. So far, we don't know what's happening on those six people who were arrested. So people need to watch out for that to see if, in fact, SO15 have got the evidence they need or not.
What was interesting about this case, obviously, the prosecution were awash in digital data, and something like, is it 80,000 Telegram messages? So Jan Mazarek was kind of managing all this totally remotely, which is kind of, it's quite fascinating, really. And also at the same time, kind of bad tradecraft as well, because as you've just saying, you know, that all the police need is to get access to this thing, and they kind of start to build a massive picture. So can you talk to us a little bit about sort of the amount of data that was involved in Mossalik's kind of remote operation going on?
There were enormous amounts of data that were downloaded. I mean, in the end, about 200,000 messages were downloaded. And it was a huge challenge for the prosecutors, because I also had some fascinating interviews exclusively with the KC, King's Counsel, marvellous woman called Alison Morgan, who was the main prosecutor. You know, relatively short woman in her, I'd say about 40, I think I dare mention what her name was, mother of children. She was also talking with the special prosecutor, who was also another amazing woman, who's I'm not allowed to name because there's concern within the CPS after the Skripal and Salisbury events about what can happen to people, about the enormous challenge of actually working with SO15 and the analysts to piece this stuff together into a manageable amount, telling a story. I mean, if you think about an analogy might be with you've been given a whole box of pieces of jigsaws. You've got no idea how many jigsaws are involved, how many parts are there and which parts are missing. And you've got to somehow, out of that, extract material that makes some sort of narratives. And then you've got to present it to a jury. And Alison Morgan was saying one of her worries before the trial started was, you know, the extent to which the jury will be able to manage this material. Because I said there were these A3 folders with endless lines of different telegrams and messages that were downloaded and then put into order. And the decision after several months of working several weekends. I mean, the special prosecutor from CBS says she took this stuff back and she had no time to resolve. Every weekend, she had to just work her way through this with the, you know, by herself, obviously in her house and somewhere on the outskirts of London, you know, having got this Meso 15 to work with them to create this narrative. And then they had to talk about it with Alison Morgan, who was brought into the case a bit later. Because the CPS special prosecutor basically was involved just before the arrests. She was there at the police station to advise on the charges. And then she worked by herself on this case with the CPS. It took a long while. I mean, one of the things that came across was how thinly resourced the public services are to do this, whether it be the CPS, SO15. Also, you know, they ramped themselves up over the period of this case being operating and after the arrests. And also when the preliminary trial hearings happen, you know, they ramped up the number of people who are involved as well. But they have to work under intense pressure. And also when the trial starts, it's all developing. So you get newer lines of inquiry or new things said in the witness box. And overnight, Alison Morgan had to say to SO15, right, you need to go through all the files and tell me, is there any evidence of this? And then, for example, Gabarova was presenting, Vanya Gabarova presenting herself as being innocent, manipulated by this kind of arch puppet master called Bazar Zambazov, who had seduced her and become her kind of lover. And she was kind of, oh, I've told all these stories about Zambazov. It's in the witness box. Zambazov was actually operating for parts of the Bulgarian government that are trying to expose corruption in Bulgaria. He was actually operating for Interpol. And so over Christmas and before Christmas, Alison Morgan said with the CPS, right, we need more messages to undermine this image of this kind of innocent. And so they introduced over Christmas 35,000 more messages. So you can get some idea of the scale of this. So they, in fact, when the trial ended, I said to the specialist prosecutor, what was your response? And she said it was, because there was a unanimous verdict, all three of them were found guilty. So all six were found guilty. She said it was relief and pride. She said, I just looked across at the SO15 people. They looked back at me. And I took several minutes of reflection. But she said that's what it's all about. It's 2 years' work was summed up in that one moment when the jury came in. So it's an immense job of work for these people. And that's why I sometimes compare it to an iceberg. It's not just what's revealed in court. You've got the people working, human beings, you know, behind the scenes, you know, to try and pull a case together and you know, take these very tricky decisions about what you reveal and what you don't. And all the time there's a sense of knowing much more than you can ever reveal in public. So if a conviction fails, like it doesn't go forward, like the recent Chinese case, for example.
And this case actually apparently influenced the CPS, allegedly. Apparently it was something in this case that and a law change that led to the Chinese case collapsing. And I'm not clear on what that was. But
Well, it's still a bit unclear. But what was interesting was talking to Alison Morgan and in a very coded way, you know, she was saying that it is crucial that before you go off and you charge people, you are sure you have enough proof for every single part of that crime. And the implication was that she thought, obviously a personal view, that when they went to the Attorney General, because what you need to do with cases like this is to get the approval, things had not been nailed down sufficiently. And in particular, I think in the case of the Chinese two men who were charged with, you know, doing work helping the Russian Chinese intelligence services, that there were aspects of it about proving, for example, that China was an enemy that couldn't be sufficiently proved. People weren't willing either to reveal enough information or they couldn't do it because Russia was obviously a different case. Because if you read the memorandum that was put in as evidence by the Deputy National Security Advisor in the Bulgarian case, you could see a lot of evidence, things like the Skripal poisoning, you know, being proved to GRU. So there's a lot of evidence of Russia. I don't know much about the Chinese case, but clearly you've not got, as far as I'm aware, examples of direct attacks, lethal. Potentially, well, lethal in the case of the killing of the innocent woman in Salisbury as a result of the activities of the Russian intelligence services. There's nothing, for example, equivalent for Chinese intelligence services in this country. So you must make sure that you know everything there is about the charges, and you've got the evidence to back up each constituent part of that criminal charge before you actually go to court for the charges to be read out and nailed against the suspects.
I just wanted to quickly ask you a little bit about the media reporting of this case and the way it was framed, because it's easy for members of the public to sometimes sort of view some of these people as not particularly important and a little bit hapless. I think even the name Austin Powers has come up in comparison occasionally.
Mr. Bean.
But, you know, what are your thoughts on the media representation of this? And also maybe, can you talk to us a little bit about also the difficulty, so it's a two-pronged question, also the difficulty of reporting on cases, active cases like this, because you've got to be careful about what information you put out because it might influence the jury. So you've got to be a bit careful about that too.
I think the narrative that was put out by parts of the media that these defendants were hapless or manipulated, sort of Keystone Cops and Mr. Bean sort of mixed all together, was partly based on truth. So it wasn't, you know, it's partly true. There were parts of their tradecraft that were pretty hapless. I mean, Ivanchev, for example, flew one of his drones into the sea when he was engaged in surveillance off the coast of Montenegro. There are other examples of, you know, the almost jokey way in which the handles which a number of the spies, Rusev and Mosalek, described themselves, you know, having one handle was Jackie Chan, another one was Mad Max, one of the people had 007 in his kind of email address and that sort of thing, were picked on by the media. But so partly true, but it's worth remembering that SO's 15 assessment, and I'll rather share this, is when you step back, you can't escape from the fact that these were amateurs, but they had a lot of pretty sophisticated equipment. They were in some ways pretty effective. I mean, the information that they gathered on Grozev and Dobrokhotov, the information they provided the Russians about other people they were keeping a watch on, who were either people that Russia had decided that was a foreign agent and they wanted back. One was a man called Kirill Kachur, a kind of false flag operation against the Kazakh embassy in London, for example, which seems to have been something that the Russians wanted to kind of organize to pretend that they had insider tracks with the Kazakh dissidents so they can then tip off the Kazakh intelligence services to then curry favor with the Kazakh government. All these things potentially were really interesting and important and potentially very dangerous operations. And, you know, it was one, for example, where Ivanova managed to get in real time on a plane with Roman Dobrokhotov and sit next to him and take a photograph of him on his mobile phone and get his PIN number. So they were doing some pretty sophisticated stuff, even though they occasionally were pretty useless and seemed to be joking about it. And also they had this running melodramatic subplot in the trial about their tangled love lives, the fact that Dumbarzov had seduced Gavarova after she'd basically ended her relationship with Ivanchev. And then Dumbarzov was lying to her, saying that he had cancer and, you know, he'd gone into hospital as a way of avoiding talking to her. And, you know, he put toilet rolls around his head to pretend he was in hospital. I mean, all of these, I mean, they beg a belief in terms of the credibility, but they make great stories for the press. And this all fed into this narrative that this spy ring were, you know, really not that serious an outfit and were more of a joke than a serious threat.
Mm. Yes, and they're making life easier for the writers of the Netflix miniseries, if there is one. I'm sure there will be at some point.
Well, actually, I've been approached by someone who's interested in doing a factual drama. The problem is, frankly, the continuing secrecy about what's going on. So I've dug out, as a result of my research since the end of the trial, a bit more about it. But, I mean, all I've added is a few pieces of the jigsaw. I think we'll need to wait for a similar time to what I had to wait for with the Portland spy ring.
Yeah.
Basically 60 years for the security service files on the case to come out in order to get and or memoirs from people who are involved to find out more about it.
Yeah, wow. Well, we are approaching the one-year anniversary of this trial, and is it the 65th anniversary of the Portland spy ring? What are your kind of thoughts on those two anniversaries coming together and the kind of comparisons and differences of the two spy cases?
Well, as I said, the Portland spy ring case and the trial happened in a very different era. And they were different as well because of the five people on trial at the Old Bailey in 1961, three of them were officers of the Russian intelligence services. All three of them were fully fledged illegals who had a training in communications, spycraft, in throwing off surveillance of them. And so that's Gordon Lonsdale and Peter and Helen Kroger. That was their cover names. And then you had the two Brits who were operating in the Portland underwater research establishment, Harry Houghton and his girlfriend. So that was quite different in that they had different status within the Russian intelligence service compared with these. The trial was over very, very quickly. It is interesting to reflect on the fact that the two cases show the way in which Russian intelligence has changed in certain ways, because although the Russians still like to have and value undercover illegals to a great extent, they're aware of the fact they're very expensive to develop and it's very high risk. You know, I mean, the FBI ghost stories cases, one where they just got rolled up, and years of work, the Russian intelligence services were just kind of destroyed in a matter of weeks. Whereas now, with a Bulgarian spy ring, you've got an example of using proxies, you know, these low-level operatives who Russia can deny, not exactly disposable, but if they are exposed, then Russia and Russian intelligence services accepts it and, you know, learns the lessons and moves on. One big difference between the two cases was the role of women lawyers. I mean, in 1961, it was the Attorney General himself, Reginald Manningham Buller, the father of Baroness Manningham Buller, who was a fairly recent Director General of the Security Service, who himself stood up in court and prosecuted. So in this case, you've got not only the two main prosecuting figures, the CPS and the independent barrister, who were women, but then a number of the defence lawyers were women as well. Completely different in 1961. And then there's some other comparisons as well. I think that there's obviously a change in the nature of the evidence. You know, in the port and spy ring, it was as an analog age. There's no mobile phones and telegram messages, need to secure digital devices. You know, obviously scraps of paper hidden somewhere in Harry Houghton's house down in near Portland that was more an issue. But what is still interesting as well is the way in which there's this balance that needs to be struck by the prosecution talking to the security service, NSO 15, about what it's willing and able to use in evidence in a case. Because obviously, if MI5, which it does, engages in covert surveillance or interception of communication, it doesn't like to reveal its techniques and what's happened before the arrest, if at all possible, because that, you know, alerts people to what's going on. And also, it may not be allowable in court for reasons of adducing evidence. So it's a really interesting comparison between 61 and 2024-25. Another interesting point about comparing the two cases is the continuing importance of intelligence cooperation between Western intelligence agencies. Both in 1961 and in 2022, it was the American intelligence community which alerted the British to these two spy rings in the first case. And, you know, you've got the Five Eyes Agreement dating back to 1946. And despite the arrival of President Trump in power, which has led to concerns in the British intelligence community about the extent to which they could trust top secret information which they passed to the Americans, from not just being blabbed out on air by people associated with President Trump's administration. There is, to this extent, I don't believe in a deep state, you know, this kind of conspiracy, but there is a kind of version of it, in my view, a benign version of it in the intelligence communities. The links between American intelligence, CIA, MI6, MI5, FBI go back a long way. And the people in those organizations tend to look through the short-term political turmoil and turbulence to the longer-term interests of their countries. And most of the people who work, well, I know from me talking a number of former MI5 people, many of them are genuine patriots. Didn't mean you just follow the line of the administration at the time. You're thinking about the longer-term interests of the citizens of the state that you're representing and how you were trying to protect them from external threats. And, you know, they work on that as best they can day after day. It doesn't mean there aren't occasional mistakes and misjudgments and things don't go wrong. But on the whole, that's what happens. And the long-term interests of those organizations are pretty well aligned. And that hasn't changed between 1961 and 2025.
Yeah, that's good. One last big question. Can you just talk to us a little bit about the sentencing that happened and maybe some of the kind of thoughts on the sentencing that the accused got?
Well, the six defendants in the Bulgarian spy ring were sentenced altogether to over 50 years in jail. They had a number of reductions because a lot of them had obviously been arrested, five out of the six, in February 2023. And so they'd been held in custody for quite a time before the actual verdict of the jury was given in February of last year, 2025. And because it was such a serious case, the vast majority of them were held in Category A prisons, i.e. high security prisons, because clearly these were people suspected of being agents of the Russian state. And the Russian state, even though these people, there's no evidence of them being officers of the Russian Federation's intelligence services, were likely to be sprung in the same way that, George Blake escaped, from their prison and ended up in the States. He wasn't actually sprung by the Russian intelligence services, but once he'd got out of the UK, they facilitated his move back. But nonetheless, that there is this issue.
Yeah, thank you for that. Well, Trevor, thank you so much for your time today. Where can listeners find out more about you and your work?
Well, if they are interested, they can have a look at my book, Dead Doubles, which we've spoken about, which still, much to my amazement, gets a number of people borrowing from public libraries and buying the odd copy. But I'm on LinkedIn, and I do this occasional journalism linked to the spy trials, and that's either published on my LinkedIn account. So please connect with me if you're interested, or indeed have a look at my articles published online for the London Standard.
Fantastic. Thank you again for today.
For listening. This is Secrets and Spies.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk. Still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.